Greetings, human! Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 41. Now for my morning becomes eclectic moment.
The song you're currently listening to is Return of the Racist Robot. It is by the band Kissing Cousins.
Alright, some other quick business. I'll be performing stand-up comedy jokes in the lovely city of Brea, California at the Brea Improv, October 21st through the 24th. Then, Wednesday, October 27th, in Los Angeles, Woodstock at Largo. I will be the Will Wheaton of Woodstock. Also on that show, Garfunkel and Oates, Mike Furman, Paul and Storm, and a special appearance by Dr. Demento. Tickets available at woodstock.net. Now back to me. I'll be heading down to Austin, Texas, November 5th to do Fun Fest. I believe a Mr. Al Yankovic will be there as well. Then after that, I'll be at Laughing Skull in Atlanta, Georgia, November 11th through the 14th. Then the week after that, the Addison Improv in Addison, Texas, near Dallas. I'm told it's home of the $30,000 millionaire, where people don't have incredibly high incomes, but they live in nice houses and drive snazzy cars. That'll be November 18th through the 20th. Also, if you would like to join the Nerdist social network, still in beta, The Node, shoot us an email over at node@nerdist.com. An exclusive offer for Nerdist podcast listeners just like you with computers and the desire to hook up with other creative nerds. All right, that's it. I'll shut up about all this stuff now. Here's the Nerdist podcast number 41 with our guest, Mr. Greg Fitzsimmons. Enjoy.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Microphones, I don't like that it says data right error, but it does record. So.
So pretty much this is horrible in every other way.
No, the Zoom H4n, it's a great...
I got the Tascam, but I use...
Tascam!
Tascam! That always just reminds me of guitars that are like, Tascam!
That's where I got it.
Our bi-weekly sale.
I heard they're having a sale coming up.
Columbus Bowl.
When are they going to have another sale? A Guitar Center.
I'll tell you, if any store in America could develop the customer service the Guitar Center has, they are phenomenal.
You know, I have to tell you, the first time I really started to bask in the power of Twitter was I took a guitar to get restrung at a Guitar Center. And then they lost it.
No!
And it wasn't ready, and I couldn't get a hold of anyone. So I just kind of angrily complained on Twitter like a bitch. I'm like, man, Guitar Center, don't ever take your guitar there if you want them to lose it.
Yeah.
25 minutes later, I get an email like, oh, hi, I'm the director of marketing for Guitar Center.
No,
and I noticed
dang.
It. And they literally, I got it that afternoon, and they didn't charge me for it. And I was like, oh, my God, this is a...
Was that to be?
But then you don't want to be the guy that complains all the time.
Yeah. I played that. Well, I got the Howard Stern card to play, and that's some powerful shit. I had a Playboy owed me some money because they wanted me to shoot some videos when I hosted the Porn Awards, and they weren't paying me because I didn't fill out some paperwork right. You know, and it just went on
sticklers,
for months.
Playboy, known sticklers for paperwork.
Yeah, exactly.
And their turnoffs are mean people, so...
and dirty fingernails.
So anyway, long story short, I finally just sent a note, an email saying, I'm going on the Howard Stern show tomorrow morning. It's going to... Thank you so much, because it's going to make such a great story. And right back, it was unnecessary for you to do that. The check will be in the mail tomorrow. And I replied, thank you. Make sure it's certified.
Of course, it's not unnecessary for them to not pay you for months and months.
I know.
Yeah, that's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you have to be really careful.
Are we recording?
Yeah, we're recording.
Oh, I didn't know this was the podcast.
Yeah,
oh,
this is it. This is it, Greg.
Trick me.
There's no, it's not
oh,
that official.
God.
It's very loosey.
That's like when you're making out with a girl and you start dry humping. She doesn't know you're going for it.
No.
And you're already done by the time she realizes it.
That's right. You've been dry humping me, Chris.
I prefer wet humping, but occasional dry humping. hop now and then is still...
I like dry fucking.
You like dry fucking. All right.
Yeah, it's dirtier.
Jesus.
What, do you actually grip your penis through your pants and just try to mash it into her pants?
I wear multiple pairs of pants at once.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's more uncomfortable for everybody.
So then you take off one pair of pants to free but imprison your penis in the second pair of pants.
Exactly. It's like you think you broke out of prison, but there's another fence.
Oh.
So your pants are like a prison to you.
Yes.
Do you wear striped pants a lot?
Striped pants? No, I do everything I can to not seem as tall as I am.
Mm.
Yeah, striped pants would just elongate.
What if this was the weirdest viral marketing campaign for Fox's Prison Break? Weird.
It's weird they wait till after the show's canceled to come up to us with this idea.
I was thinking about how like MSNBC has all the prison shows.
Yes.
And how fascinated we are with rehab and prisons. And then those murder shows where it goes on for an hour and you get into the mind of the murder. And I thought, why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think there's a broader thing that's going on in television that's really interesting, which is that pretty much every show right now has a despicable protagonist.
Yeah.
And so,
that's true. Dexter,
Mad Men, Modern Family, they're kind of dicks.
Breaking Bad.
Modern Family or dicks?
Weeds. Well, I mean, I just think they're sort of like, they're not dicks, but they're just sort of like ornery. Is that a good word?
I think that's a bad example, Chris.
No, I think
I'm
going to
call you on Modern Family. You got two likable gay guys, which you've never had on TV before.
I'm thinking more about the Ed O'Neill character.
All right, then just say Ed O'Neill. But don't throw the cast in there.
What?
He's curmudgeonly.
He is curmudgeonly. But with a soft spot.
I think it kind of started, though, with Seinfeld and how kind of awful they were.
Yeah, that's why, like, you know, you think
I think it might have started with Norman Lear and Archie Bunker.
It's like Always Sunny Philadelphia is kind of like the apex of just, like, everybody's horrible and it's like there's no repercussions.
I think it might have started with Macbeth.
I think it could have started with Aristophanes.
I think it started with the serpent in the Garden of Eden.
Oh shit.
Damn.
I'm not going to... I mean, we could go Cro-Magnon, but that's bullshit. You know, a cave wall drawing is really going too far.
Just a cranky buffalo is the lead character in some sort of... That buffalo's a dick, however they would have said that.
But he's got a soft spot.
In the soft spot, in the...
Do you think they knew their drawings were shitty on the walls, or were they like, that's really good? Really
not back then, though. I mean, who else was doing it?
It wasn't exactly a smooth surface.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
It was kind of a punk movement, probably in Neolithic times to start drawing on. I hope it was Neolithic and not like Mesolithic because I'll get called on it.
Well, Meso is middle, right?
Middle, yes, so, the middle stone.
Guys, we all know it was roughly 6,000 years ago. Go ahead.
All right. I'm sure for them it was very punk to express ideas like by drawing on a wall. I'd be like, I never thought of a buffalo that way.
Yeah. And I didn't know he was a Crip.
Shit. And the other guy's like, what's a buffalo?
I don't know. What are these words we're using right now? I'm going to kill you and rape your woman. All right, everyone, let's go home.
These are the days.
Wait, which are the women?
Merchant, yeah.
They're much softer. Thank you for pointing that out.
Bitch, you got to shave your pussy with a sharp rock. Like that's pretty much other.
How would you know where the hair was when it's all over the body? It'd be funny if they only shaved their vagina, but they still had full back hair.
It's like everything else, yeah.
They got a landing strip on their back.
Yeah, it's sort of like a full body version of the Lincoln beard, where it's just like that. Everything's just like a scoop neck, but then that one part should be
so you can find it.
Yeah,
it's like a hole in a golf green.
Yeah,
just make it a little lighter.
Gotta sink that putt.
That's what it is. And they put a little cup in there. And then a flag. They put a flag in there. And that's how you knew in
caveman
times.
And how do you blame Tiger? You know, I mean, this is what he's looking at all
day. I mean, this goes back thousands of years.
Yes.
So it's really
It's been
not,
building.
Yeah, that's all it is.
Now, back then, they didn't have Waffle House waitresses. But, you know, this was Mesolithic.
Yeah.
What if they did? There were no Waffle Houses.
Bison House. Bison House. You're going in for shitty, dirty bison waffles.
They're so bad for you, but they're so good!
So good! I feel like Bison Waffles should be the name of something, so if anyone out
Bison
there...
Waffles sounds like a name of, like, an asshole. I introduce to you bison waffles.
Like an ass, like if you're eating someone's asshole, no, you're like, I had bison
like
waffles.
Just some shitty dude.
I thought you meant literally that it was like a euphemism for someone's asshole where you're like, yeah, I ate bison waffles last night. Like,
actually, that's better.
Okay. Well, it fits in with the whole theme of like buffalo wings.
I guess it does.
You know, you could have a whole Cro-Magnon menu at a comedy club.
That would be. That, guys, KB's. Come on. We're going to open KB's. It's cave themed.
There's a place in the city of industry called Jurassic Restaurant.
Well, there's a place called the City of Industry. Like that's the funny part of that.
But they have like Asian waitresses dressed up like cave girls, and they serve you.
How big are the ribs? Do they when they take it out to your car?
They probably have regular human sized ribs.
No, they probably have like teriyaki dill ribs. Come on, is this a Flintstones episode?
This might be a Flintstones episode. I want to ask you because you've been. When did you start doing stand up?
I started in my senior year of college, basically, so 1989.
And you grew up in Boston?
New York.
You grew up in New York.
But I started doing stand-up when I was in college in Boston.
So what, because I don't know, is the Boston, because there was a period of time, and we talked to Bill Burr about this too, but Boston was the comedy scene for a long time, and I don't know if I've heard a lot lately about the Boston comedy scene. Is it still a force?
On January 12th, it's going to be a force when I'm at the Wilbur Theater.
Nice.
What happened was what's kind of happened to the most industries, which is there were. I'm not exaggerating because it was a closed community. Very, very few comics came from outside. Mm-hmm. Boston had its own headliners, its own features, its own open mic nights, and there were like six or seven full-time, seven-night-a-week clubs.
Holy shit.
And it's a big city, but it's not a huge city. And so growing up there, or coming up there, it was crazy. I mean, I started out with like Joe Rogan and... Bill Burr, Dave Cross, Mark Maron, Sarah Silverman, and we were all just, you know, signing up, waiting for a spot. But within 6 months, if you had a car, you were working. Because the headliners all had DUIs, so they couldn't drive to the gigs. So it wasn't if you had a strong 10 minutes, it was, do you have a full tank of gas?
Right.
So you would drive and you'd pick up ex-headliner. And you'd drive them up to Worcester or down to Providence, and you'd do your time. And then you just moved up really fast because you've got so much good stage time. Mm-hmm. And yet, I've talked to Bill about this, you have to have your own persona because it's not tolerated to be like somebody else. And it's really not tolerated to have a joke like anyone else.
And that's what's so interesting is to see like what a crusade Joe Rogan has taken upon joke thievery. Like it's interesting.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to see the roots of that in
that's where it is
in the Boston comedy scene.
Yes, yes, it was. I can remember a guy getting punched in the face for taking a joke, and there was one or two guys that had a bad reputation, and it was like looking back. They didn't really steal. I mean, when I see the thievery that goes on today, these guys were like, had a nuanced version of something a guy once did. And I mean, they were fucking marked for life.
Wow.
So it made you really have to be original. And at the same time, the crowds were so, I mean, fucking shut up, faggot. Next. I mean, you had to, it was saloon comedy. You had to grow balls, thick skin. And, you know, and it was all about, follow that, motherfucker. Like, right. Every comic was trying to bury the guy after him. That's how you moved up. So it was good. It was basic training. And now there's one club. If that. I don't even know if that one club's open. Faneuil Hall Comedy Club.
No, it's gone. I was just there, and it's just...
Matthew's from Boston.
Are you really?
Yeah, they bought the Wilbur Theater.
Yeah, and it was basically, you know, they drove all the other clubs out of business by buying up all the ad space in the newspapers, bringing in headliners from out of town, and they basically redefined what comedy was in Boston. I mean, I'm sure you saw
it. And now it's just the Wilbur Theater, and you can go out to Kowloon to the Comedy Connection on Route 1.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, which is that? That's where all the big hair nightclubs used to be, and the crowds. It was like Jersey Shore times 300 people.
Jesus.
Yeah.
So you probably moved. You probably hopped pretty quickly from Boston to New York, I assume.
Yeah, I was going back and forth for a while. You know, and I'd stay in my dad's apartment in the city, and I would drive. I would do shows. You know, Saturday night would be usually my last show. I'd be in like Worcester, mm-hmm. and then I'd drive to New York, and then. You know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I'd, you know, just hang around the clubs trying to get spots in New York, go back to Boston and make a few bucks. Did that for like 2 years. And then I was kind of in. And luckily, some of the comics that did come up from New York, like Eddie Brill and Colin Quinn, were really good about helping me get in at some of the clubs in New York. Yeah.
So did you have a... By the way, Greg, one of the things that's really funny to me about you is that you're a comic, but I also know you're a comic who... is not afraid to punch people in the face.
No. No. Like, why? What are you saying?
I think it's great. It's like, because you and I are about the same size.
Yeah.
But whereas I would weigh, like, if I was, you know, in a situation where I'm like, oh, I can't hit someone in the face. Like Greg would be the kind of guy that you'd just be like, eh, fuck this, bam.
Yeah.
Like, if someone was really asking for it.
Yeah, I just feel like as an Irish person, I'm so suppressed. I mean, there's an unhealthy way to punch somebody in the face, and there's a healthy way, and I like to think I'm the latter, which is you have to honor your emotions, right? And if you don't, they're going to spill over to other parts of your life. Now, I'm not saying punching people in the face, but like... by not getting angry when you're really angry, like, I think it's really healthy to yell at people when you're really mad. Mm-hmm. And in Hollywood, in New York, that's totally normal and accepted. Like, Europe, even more so. L.A., you are never, ever allowed to show that you're mad at somebody. You just tell them to their face that you're fine, and then nobody ever knows where
they stand. It's a passive-aggressive culture. It's a very passive-aggressive culture.
So I yell at people. And I mean, I've worked on TV shows where I yell, and I just assume that it's in the moment and we move on. And then people hold on to it, and I realize, wow, I can't get out of this now. So I punch them in the face and I quit.
I'm just being true to myself.
No, I'm working on that. I'm actually I've been going to a lot of therapy because I had some road rage problems happen, and then I attacked a parent at a camping trip with my kids.
And,
can you tell us about that?
Well, the guy threatened my son supposedly stole a hiking stick from the guy's daughter on a camping trip.
Okay.
And so the guy didn't know who did it. There were three boys, and the guy, with none of the parents around, big dude, corners the three boys and threatens them and says, I know where you live, blah, blah. All three boys are crying. I see my son. He's like trembling. And my son's a pretty tough kid. He's been in Taekwondo for like 6-7 years.
Right.
He's close to being a black belt. Plays club soccer. You know, he's not afraid. He's trembling. And I'm like, it's like back to nature. You fuck with my kid, I will kill.
Yeah.
And so I walk up to this guy and he's at his tent and I just walk right up to him and I just slam him in the chest. And he steps backwards a couple steps, and I just got nose to nose, and I go, you got 5 minutes to find my kid, apologize, then pack your shit and get the fuck out of here. And he did it.
Really?
He did it.
That's fantastic.
And, but then I stopped him, and I said, you don't have to go. I lost my temper and blah, blah, blah. And then I didn't apologize, but I made it right the next morning, and we all went on a hike.
And then you made love in a cave where there were some drawings of bison.
You were in the woods?
I was watching. I was there. Hey, that guy is here right now. Let's bring him on out.
Oh, my God.
Greg, thanks for setting me straight.
Wait, you just made me get really horned up about that Chilean Mayan.
Is that
what? I mean, Jesus, that's what's going on. And then wonder they wouldn't come out.
Yeah, that's why.
Apparently, the wives and the mistresses are fighting because they're all there waiting for them.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah. That's the story they're not giving enough attention to. And the story they're giving way too much attention to is second guy came up with rocks. Got it. He brought rocks up and gave them as gifts.
Some of them were probably in his lungs because he was living underground for 2 months.
But, you know, they're killing so much time waiting for the next guy to come up, but they can't cut away from this scene.
Yeah.
And so they just, for some reason, they keep telling the rock story again and again and again.
I think there's a reality story somewhere in the Miners' Wives and Mistresses. I think there's...
That's the angle.
We're in the E building right now. We could go pitch it 30 feet from here. We could go pitch it right now.
The show is, to me, is the pitches that must happen in the E building.
Oh, yeah, I could, yeah, I've heard some. And because I'm still employed here, I probably can't say what they are, but...
I can. I mean, I've done...
Plastic.
Well, I did a show, did I ever shoot it? I think I sold it, but we didn't shoot it, and it was about a couple that casts these shows, these reality shows, and it's just... people coming in, and it's really just about a room like this, a conference room, and watching people get interviewed. Mm-hmm. Because the show is bought, and they're trying to cast the people in the houses or whatever. And it's just, it was just about that. And I can't remember why it didn't go. But that, to me, that's what's interesting about these shows is like, they're so, I'm sorry, America, I'm going to pull the sheet back over this.
What?
The curtain back. The sheet.
Pull the sheet back.
That's,
sheet back.
That's a new reality show.
That's clanny. Pull the sheet back. When Klansmen get together and share their feelings.
Come on, brother, just pull the sheet back. We're all the same here, I hope.
When hate turns to love. And it's amazing, because I've worked on some reality shows. It's amazing how completely choreographed it is. I mean, I've produced them, and you have to come up with a beat sheet for what's going to happen in each act, between each character.
Of course. Yeah, and that's, you know, it's what I... Because, you know, years ago, when I worked at MTV, my girlfriend was on The Real World, and so it was when they when those first couple...
Your first season?
No, she was on the London cast, fourth season. So what would happen is every new cast in the beginning, where reality television was still very new, they would always watch the first episode, and all the kids would be like, what the fuck is this? Because they would take a snippet of dialogue from one thing that happened, marry it to something that happened 6 months later, and then
apply grab a long, awkward pause.
Right, and then apply it to something that none of the first two quotes, you know.
Yeah.
And then the producers were like, hey, we never said it was real. It's a reality-based soap opera. Oh, so they have to build characters, and they have to categorize people. And, you know, if someone's recording everything you do all the time, they can paint you in any light they want.
Yeah, it's a collage. And I love that, too, is like when somebody says something like, well, you're not welcome in the house anymore. And then they grab a piece of downtime where they were all just hanging out, looking around, and they put, like, the cricket noise under it.
I always feel like the cricket should have gotten its own credit.
Yeah. I know. Can you imagine the after residuals? Oh, forget it. There would be locust swarms all over the country partying.
It is amazing to me that they didn't... I wonder if the miners were able... I guess they weren't able to really take any footage.
Oh, yeah, they did.
No, they did. They sent down a camera.
Oh, they did send down a camera? Yeah.
Now, there was one guy who had never worked a camera, but he learned it, and he became the camera guy, and he actually got a shot of the guy bringing the rocks up.
Oh, my God.
Yes!
Really? The guy brought rocks?
He brought rocks up.
This is the true story. The true story of 12 miners picked to live in a cave.
See what happens when...
Why do they have Mexican accents?
Because that's the only one I can do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in my ethnocentric brain, that is the only... I got an argument on my website because... Did you see the Simpsons opening from the other night?
No, I heard it was a big deal.
It was pretty incredible. This British graffiti artist named Banksy wrote it, made it, and it basically is just like, it just goes to a sweatshop and they're making cells and they're like shredding kittens to stuff Bart dolls and they're... punching holes in a DVD with a unicorn horn.
Yeah.
And the licking
envelopes
with the dolphin head.
Yeah, the dolphin
head. And so I made some point about like, oh, you know, it's funny they're making fun of the Korean sweatshop. And all these people were like, clearly because there's a panda in it and because of the style of collar on their shirts, it's Chinese. Jeez. And I'm like, no, that's a fucking, like, everyone knows that animation happens in Korea. That's where U.S. outsources it. You know, that's just a stupid ethnocentric, like, oh, they're Asian, so let's put a panda in there. Like,
they
don't look at the details to geo... Like, that's just a mistake on the part of the writers.
Yeah.
It's like if you... And also, dolphin head, that's Japanese. The Japanese are the ones that kill the dolphins all the time.
Wait, what?
What? Why is it the Japanese men need so much help getting erections from endangered animals? Like... I think about... I mean, it's...
Wait, you just painted a picture of just like a like an eagle just gingerly coaxing a Japanese cock out with its little fore feather. Just like... Like, and he's trying to just like... What do you mean?
And the Japanese guys go... Well, it's always like, you know, the tusk of an elephant in a soup or shark fin
soup.
There's all these aphrodisiacs. And I always think to myself, is there a hotter species of woman than the Japanese woman? Isn't that enough for you guys?
Well, I don't know if they're a species, but...
Is it not a species?
No, they'd be... They would just be a race.
Are they made in a Korean sweatshop?
Yes, they are. But unfortunately, there are pandas there, so it confuses people into thinking that they're made in China.
Do you think that the Japanese men are fucking pandas?
I feel like there must be... Probably like an Avatar where, you know, he tamed that big bird. There must be some sort of an honor in being able to stick
Japanese,
it to a panda.
The Japanese are perverted enough that they have to not allow cell phone cameras to not make a noise when you take a picture.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I had a I did have a Japanese iPhone for a while because I couldn't shut the click feature off. And I went online and I was like, why does my phone, it won't silence
the... Why, so they can get like upskirt shots?
So they can't,
because it'll make a noise.
It always makes a noise.
Wow.
You expect it's like, you know, their ancestors were dosed in tons of radiation, so this current, you know...
By...
Us.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I don't, but the thing that's interesting...
I love that we're shitting on them, and we're the ones that caused it.
Yeah. Why are they like crazy colors all the time? It's because something went wrong.
Why do people cry when we bomb them? Like...
Why are they bad at sports? We radiated their equipment.
We're terrible. America, you guys!
Wait, going back to... I wanted to tell a quick story about Chile, by the way, because I was there last year.
Okay. I hope it involves rocks.
It rocked. We were shooting a pilot for an unnamed network, and they were trying to save money by moving it down to Chile, because they had studios down there. And they flew down. It was a game show, and they flew down a black family from South Central, and I mean black, like, you know, the real deal. You know, have never been outside of Los Angeles. Like, cool, funny, tight, and just loud. Mm-hmm. You know, and we go to Chile, and they've never seen a black person in their lives. And so we go down there, and we're a circus walking through. And the expense of flying down 8 family members, an entire crew, not an entire crew, half a crew. And then they use the Chilean crew down there in the studio. So the first day, they had to fire the Steadicam guy, who's the one with the headphones on, who's supposed to be catching shots the director's telling him to catch. He's missing everything. Turns out, doesn't speak English. Fired. Next day, I'm staring at the teleprompter. It's always ahead of me or behind me.
Yep.
And it turns out the guy who was fired the day before, he's running the teleprompter now.
The guy that doesn't speak English is running the teleprompter.
He's same guy. He changed hats. He had a Yankees hat the first day, and the next day he had another Raiders hat. and we got nothing. There was a soundproof booth that the family had to go into so they wouldn't hear the answers. It was not only soundproof, it was airtight. And it was 1,000,000 degrees. So during commercial breaks, they'd rip the door open. They'd come out sweating. We'd have to towel them down. It was fucking
hilarious. That poor family was like, this is why we don't leave South Central. You stick us in a Chilean sweat box.
Exactly. So I feel for the miners. I know the family. The black family knows exactly how those miners felt.
Well, at least someone here does. It's so funny that... It's fascinating to me that I want to know what were those caves like? Are there images of the caves where they were living? How do you live for 2 months?
Well, there was a fresh spring water. There was water. I guess I don't know if it was running through. It must be running through. It couldn't be still water. But yeah, they had a water source. There was a 4-inch tube going down, so they were fed.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they got the camera down there, and. Apparently they NASA got involved, so there was all that space food going down there. But they were like, they came up clean shaven. One guy looked like he'd been down there for half an hour.
That's the Chileans. They're a slick, sexy bunch.
They're chill.
They look good.
That's why they named that country that.
It's funny when I ran into you when you came to the building, and you said to me that when you see me walking toward you. You feel like you're looking in a mirror because we have the exact same body type.
Yes.
Like, exactly the same body type.
No real muscular development, but yet fit.
That's right.
And like 100, I'm 150, you're like 145.
Something like that, yeah.
And we're about, you're a little taller than me, but we have that look like... Yeah, we've never done a real sport, but we have exercised.
Maybe we could play racquetball.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't swim, but we have dove in the water and then come back to the side.
Yeah, look out, badminton. We could tear up some shuttlecocks. But I think it's because you remember me when I was on the plumper side back in the old days. Mm-hmm. You don't drink any. You don't drink either, do you?
20 years.
Holy shit! I just had 7, but 20 is pretty insane.
Well, I think really once you get over the hump of, I mean, 7's funny because with marriage it's the 7-year itch,
right?
And it really is like the first 5 or so are like. You change your life. I mean, you lose some friends.
Yeah.
You change some lifestyle stuff. And I think when people can't stop, it's really because there's so much of their life they're afraid to let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And you've done that by five. And then when you hit seven, you realize, I'm bored. You know, and you start to think, well, you forget how it was and you forget how good this clarity is.
I never forget. Like, I feel like I was really lucky because I'm not an AA guy. And I think a lot of people assumed... I wasn't going to say anything about it, but on Twitter I made a point to say, like, hey, I just had a 7-year anniversary and I'm only saying this just so to let you guys know that if you're struggling with an addiction, you can overcome it. Because I was a insane fucking booze hound. Crate insane.
You were a big beer guy, though.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, like just drinking beer every day, all the time. And so, you know, when I quit... Part of it was vanity. Like, I lost a lot of weight really fast. And so I'm like, oh, this isn't so bad. Like, I was able to see the physical results.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you were probably exercising more, right?
No, I've been exercising now for about 5 years.
Uh-huh.
But also just not eating pizza at 4 o'clock in
yes.
the morning and not, you know, like, and sleeping kind of a little bit more regular hours. And
yeah.
Then, you know, like, that all helped. But... it's interesting, and I was never, you know, I went to AA a couple times, and I'm sorry to say this, I hated it. Like, I did not, and I thought I was broken, because I'm like, I'm supposed to love AA, and I would leave feeling worse than when I went there.
Yeah.
But then I talked to a couple other comics, and I was like, I think there's something wrong with me. They were like, I didn't go to AA, you know? I had a therapist I liked, so it's, you know, like, that's how I was working out my issues.
Yeah, I think that AA is something that really works for. I knew people that have, you know, one of my relatives has been going for like 40 years, and I mean 3-4 days a week, work at, you know, sponsor, working the steps, doing the work, and you know, I kind of did that with Al-Anon because mm-hmm. my father was an alcoholic, and I very much connected to Al-Anon. I was in a room full of people that were talking about. Really much more of the, you know, dysfunctional impact on your life and mm-hmm. And certain behaviors that you had were not your fault. And when you hear that we all had these same, you know, low self-esteem things or inabilities to relate to, it was really, really worked for me. And then I went to an AA meeting and I felt like I was in French 3 and I'd never learned. I didn't connect to anything anybody was saying.
And it's not to, and I'm not bashing AA at all, because like you said, it works for some people and it's awesome. And my feeling is, like, whatever works for you should do.
Yeah.
But for me, like, I would go and I'd be feeling pretty good about my, you know, like, oh, I feel pretty good that I'm kind of changed my life in this way. And I would go in and just hear these awful stories and see people that were so shattered internally. And I just left. I would leave with the residue of that. And like,
yeah.
I feel a lot worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough because if you didn't have a low bottom, and it's kind of hard to sit there and not feel like, am I even an alcoholic? And I mean, some of these people, they want to. Rick Shapiro, you know Rick Shapiro,
yeah.
Brilliant comic, and he has this bit about AA about how he's like a. Guy talking to a sponsor, he's like, I don't know, sometimes Donnie doesn't feel that good about Donnie. You know, last week, I got up, my nephew's making noise, I kicked him in the teeth, I knocked him down, his mother yelled at me, I skull-fucked her, I went outside, I had road rage, and the sponsor goes, did you drink? No. Then you're a winner!
That is, I am impressed that that 20 years ago, you know, in comedy, that you were able at that time.
Well, it was because of comedy. I told you about the driving the other comics.
Yeah.
And I knew, well, I also knew, I was, a lot of comics I think can relate to this, is that I really was never good at anything. I mean, I played every sport, never well. I did not get good grades because I have like ADHD. And I was a skinny, pale, redheaded, freckled kid who...
Not afraid to punch people, though.
Where do you think the anger came from? I got in a lot of fights, I had a bad temper, and then comedy really, truly was the first thing I ever did that I went, like, not only have I been dreaming of this, but I think I'm actually good at this.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first time I was on stage drunk, it was January 4th, 1990, I said, that's it. I was drunk, I felt confused, mm-hmm. and I felt ashamed, and I got off and I was in a black depression, and that's the last drink I ever had in my life.
That's really interesting you say that, because I one of the, like, near the end for me, I was on stage at the Improv and I was drunk and my head was totally cloudy, and Gary Shandling and Greg Kinnear were in the audience, and I had a rotten set and I literally couldn't focus my brain.
Yeah.
And that was when I started kind of going, like, because some people think, like, I got to be fucked up to do my art.
Oh, please.
And I'm like,
I really actually just the opposite. I've never seen that work. I mean, I've seen it work briefly.
What about Stanhope, though?
I haven't seen the guy, though.
I saw Stanhope on stage once, and he had, because people just send him drinks, like, that sort
of.
So he had a stool, a bar stool, and there was a shot of tequila, a flute of champagne, and then a beer, and they were all resting kind of precariously, pointing outward like they were all about to fall off the stool at any minute, because it was a cushiony stool.
Yeah.
And they didn't, and he just managed to, like, polish them off.
Anyone send a puke bucket up there?
No. His tolerance is pretty high.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I think it's, adding to my... shame on my the last, when I was on stage that time, it was, and you're going to think I'm making this up, but this is true, they used to raise money for a children's hospital in Boston by having this benefit show once a year, and it was called Tits for Tots. And all of the prostitutes and the strippers, because Nick's Comedy Stop is in the red light district, and it was a mob place. And all this, I mean, there was a place called Dominic's across the street where all the hookers hung out between their gigs and the comics hung out between their gigs.
Yeah, freshening up, getting pizza.
Well, we had a lot in common.
Yeah, of course.
And so we would go, they would have this show at Nick's Comedy Shop during the day, and it was all union guys from Southie, you know, tough guys. And then the women would walk around topless with hats, and then you would be on stage telling jokes. And that's when I bombed. So, I mean... That intensifies the shame of bombing.
Oh, no. You bombed during Tits for Tots?
Tits for Tots for the kid. I let the kids down.
You let the kids down. I mean, these ladies are out here working, like, giving it all they got.
Yeah.
You know, like, taking out their tits for kids, and then you were up on stage.
And they're not drunk. They're sober. They're focused.
Well, they might be drunk on the filth of where their lives have gone.
Absolutely. And meth.
And a little bit of meth, too, but not
no
drunk.
No alcohol. No drinking. I mean, this is a hospital.
Then they're winners.
And I'm sucking a dick, and this guy's fingering my asshole, and my pimp has got a gun pointed at my head. Did you drink? No. Then you're a winner!
I mean, you know, he was fingering my asshole to pack the coke up in there tighter. I just want to get in my bloodstream faster. But I did not take a drink.
I heard it. But did you drink?
No! Oh, that's really funny. Are you, so then, because your dad was a radio guy.
Yes.
And you fell in with the Stern Show, it's been a while now, right?
About 10 years. Well, you know when it started? You and I were at the Aspen Comedy Festival together in 2001. Yes.
I have to say, so Greg won the stand-up award that year for the festival, and, who presented to him? It was Catherine O'Hara. Presented him with the award, and she just had a little lav mic on her jacket, and it was clear that Greg wasn't supposed to talk.
I was told not to talk.
And so, and still, anyway, he grabbed her collar and just leaned in, and he was like, yeah, just really appreciate this award, and just want to say the other comics... Not that funny. Not that funny.
Meanwhile, Chris was on my... We had like a... There was a set of like 4 or 5 comics that you performed together
right.
The whole time. And it was me, you, and Jim Norton, I think.
Was it Norton?
And it was so much fun. It was such a blast. And then, and then they told me I couldn't make a speech. And so, and I remembered Keckner and Naked Trucker.
Naked Trucker was there, yeah.
They won the sketch thing, and they were horrified that I did it. They were not happy that I did it. And that's how it started. Like, I remember it was at an award ceremony when I was about 9, and I have a picture from it. I was wearing a plaid blazer. And I had won like 7th place in backstroke, but they still give you like an award because you're a kid.
Right.
And so, you know, and they're giving out 100 awards. And I get up and I got a picture of it. I grabbed the mic and I thank my parents and Ronald Reagan. And I just kept going on. And that's to me where it all started, was like classrooms. Anytime there's an assembly of people,
mm-hmm.
I think it's just a Marx Brothers thing. It's just about... How do I take this, you know, you know, stuffy environment and do something silly.
And that's how you know you should be a comic. When people say, because people always come up with shows and they're like, I don't know, should I do comedy? And it's like, if you're supposed to do it, you will do it.
Yeah.
And you will continue to do it no matter what happens. No matter how many tits for tots episodes you go through, you
yeah.
will still want to get up and do it.
Yeah, there's three things I'd like to see comics stop doing, which is number one, asking people if they should do it.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, asking how they can get an agent so they can get some work. Same thing. If you're funny, they are waiting for you. There
right.
is there is a huge demand for truly funny people.
Yeah. And that's their job. They'll find you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the third one is, don't ask me to open for them. I don't bring openers on the road because
right.
I can barely keep my life together as it is. I don't need an extra 12 phone calls acting as your agent because I got to call the club. I got to call my agent. And then you're not happy with the money and I'm supposed to go back and forth.
Right.
And then when I get there, guess what I want to do when I'm in Minneapolis for the weekend? Not hang out with the opening act. So there's no upside to it. And I never did it once. I used to mail out tapes. I fucking drove down the East Coast with Tom Cotter. We went to 7 comedy clubs between Boston and Florida auditioning, doing 5-minute sets for free to get in. I don't know what this whole entitlement thing now is with comics. How can I get an agent, make a living? Will you bring me on the road? No, shut the fuck up.
Yes, a lot of comedy clubs have shut down. So it's, you know, like
it's because of those comics.
It's because of those people.
Do you bring someone on the road with you?
No, only because it's, well, if I'm doing an isolated date, somewhere, like, I'll try
Does
to
that
get...
mean no one shows up for the show?
No. No. No, but believe me, I did go through that for a long time. But, I mean, like, if I'm just doing a small theater or a rock club or something,
yeah.
like, because some markets that don't necessarily have good comedy clubs, like, you just go in and do, like, a show or two in a theater.
Yeah.
You know, and so I'll try to bring Mike Furman on some of those. But it just doesn't make sense.
No, because most clubs don't pay flight or room.
No,
for the feature
act. You know, they'll pay a feature act like maybe $75 a show.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have a lot of guys, you know, guys who are fucking awesome comics like Tommy John again or whatever, but they'll just live in the Midwest. And then that way they can just drive to like, there's just like a wealth of clubs that they can hit if they
yeah.
live in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Then they don't have to worry about travel. And then, you know, then the money, then they actually kind of make a little bit of money. But, like, if someone flew to feature for me, they would literally lose
money. Exactly. And, you know, there's guys that live in certain areas that I will call the club and ask to work with. Because,
yeah.
you know, we stay in touch and I know they're good. And that's the other thing. I get people that email me and go, hey, I see you're in the Dallas area. Can you ask if I can open for you? And it's like, I don't know you. I don't know if you're funny. And if you're not funny, it's on me. I
right.
brought a guy up to Cobb's in San Francisco. He tanked every show, and the club owner was furious at me.
Tom Sawyer?
Yes.
Was it Tom Sawyer? I
yes.
know Tom.
I won't tell you who the comic was, though.
I don't... damn. That's all right. We don't need to...
It was Dane Cook.
Okay. No,
I'm kidding. I love Dane. That was an ironic use of Dane Cook as the go-to punching bag comic.
No, please, because I've talked about this on the show before. I never actively went to Dane Cook for a punchline.
Well, you're the opposite of a hater. You're a lover.
I guess that's true, but I had a couple experiences with him where I personally kind of was like, oh, you know what? Fuck you. Like,
wow.
Like, he did some kind of arrogant, I'm a rock star shit. And it really put me off. And then
he went through that stage. Absolutely.
Is he nice? Like, because I don't give a fuck what, like, I almost, you know, as much of a comedy snob as I am, I am willing to bend what I would normally like or not like. If someone's cool, like if someone's nice, then I will be like, okay, I get, you know, I see it. I get what they're doing. I like it, you know, but I don't know.
I don't even mix the two. I can hate the comic, love his comedy. Or vice versa.
I can't
separate. One has no effect on the other for me.
I cannot separate.
Some of my
separate.
Biggest friends are the biggest hacks in the business.
Oh, really?
And vice versa. I mean, there's guys that I fucking detest, and I will stand in the back of the room and watch every word of their act.
Right.
So, but getting back to Dane, you know, and again, started with him in Boston, same
mm-hmm.
time. And that dude, open mic night, Nick's Comedy Stop, 30 people in the crowd. He's on first. 31 comics performing.
Sure.
At the end of the show, if he went on first, he's at the door shaking everybody's hand. He wanted fame. He
yeah.
wanted to be a rock star. And when he got it, Yeah, his head blew up, and he's the first to admit he should have been better to comics.
Right.
And I had him on my podcast not long ago, and I highly suggest you have him on because he's very forthright about it.
Well, I don't want to like corner him because Maron did that. Like, I don't need.
Oh,
to.
I didn't hear that.
Was
he rude to him?
I don't know if he was rude.
It was Maron.
yeah. But, what am I saying?
You know, I'm if I had him on, I would sort of be interested in talking to him about, because listen, here's the truth of the matter is. You can't get to superstardom by accident. Like you it's fucking work.
Fight for it.
It's work.
Yes.
And so I'm interested. You know, like I'd be interested in his work ethic and you know, like how do you? I'm always fascinated by people who become super successful, and then how do you have a barometer at that point? How do you know if what you're doing is good? How do you know if you're taking good projects? Because
it's not about. Your what's turning you on as an artist, it's becoming about what your agent, manager, and publicist is telling you are the right moves to go.
And how do you know if they're giving you good advice? Like, you know, it's just, it's a really, like...
And it's a compromise. You do a little of one to do more of the other, you know? You do a bad movie so you can do that good movie.
Right. Yeah. But it's how do you know that the movie is good? It's just, when you have all of the choices in the world, then it almost becomes overwhelming. Like, when you can do anything you want...
Yeah, I mean, I like a guy like Tim Robbins because you see that he has his own production. He's one of the few A-list guys that has his own production company and truly reads scripts, finds projects he's passionate about, either directs or is in them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he has managed to keep his star, what's the metaphor? Keep his star shining?
In bloom? Wait, that's wrong.
No, wait a minute. Keep his, he polishes his...
So he polishes his stars.
So he, but I mean, I think that's a rare thing. I mean, you stick to, you know, John Cusack comes to mind as another guy.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah. I'd like to see him avoid Spielberg for a little while.
Like literally, but just avoid him in public. Like, yeah. Tom! Oh, Steve.
But anyway, so I think that, you know, you are... a good example of somebody who I think has stayed true to your roots, and you, fortunately, there's a geek channel that shot up in unison with your interest in
it. It really, literally helped. Like just the way that technology and culture went was just a happy accident. Of
yes.
Those are the things that I love.
Yes,
and
but
so
you've also
helpful.
Been really proactive about doing things like this podcast and tweeting and being. You know, available to your fans, and which is hard. I mean, I talk to 9 out of 10 comics are so afraid of not just the technology, but the intimacy mm-hmm. of the fans. And a lot of us got into it because we do have a hard time with interpersonal relationships, and it's much easier for us to manage a collection of people that don't talk back.
Yeah, I guess
and
that's true.
And then what you do is rare. And how do you find that? It's hard to make boundaries with people.
Well, social networks and, you know, Twitter make it easy to, like, there's just enough of a boundary there. Because obviously, if all those people emailed you all, you just literally wouldn't have time to email everyone
yeah.
back. So being able to address people in groups, that makes it a little bit easier. But I also really like talking to people, so like I go out after every show, and if people want to say hi or take pictures or chat, I love doing that because
I'm fascinated.
Like, first of all, I appreciate that they're there.
I want to know why they're there.
I love to know why they're there, how they found out about the show, and there's, you know, there's almost like a there's almost like a statistician thing where you kind of come out and you be like, oh, these people knew from Chelsea or the website or Web Soup, and
yeah.
they all have these weird similarities that, you know, that tie them together. And like, it's just the fascinating human economics of it is also really intriguing to me.
Yeah, it's like there's no one performer that will draw the exact same crowd. There's a weird, like, whatever things you've done in your career have drawn X number of people, and it cross-pollinates. And it wanes. I mean, yeah, I certainly see, like, I used to do Best Week Ever for 5 years, and I used to get great turnout from that. And when that went off the air, 5 minutes later, those fans were gone.
Really?
Disposable. Whereas, like, with Howard, you know, I don't go on nearly as often as I used to, but, I mean, once you're in that circle, you've got Stern fans forever.
And how and are they – do you like the Stern fans? I mean, like, are they people that – because I was – I look at the nerds that come out to my show, and I'm like, I would hang out with you guys.
Yeah.
Like, do fans come to your show? That
well,
you would,
I don't
like,
think there's a
with?
Stern fan the way I think your collection of fans, I think, is very specific to this world. And I feel like the Stern guys, there's the original ones, that, you know, the guys from Long Island who are read the New York Post and, you know, and just want it. They want to hear, you know, they want to hear shit that's outrageous. And then you have like Hollywood. I mean, to a person that's an executive in this town, they listen.
That's true.
If they don't listen, they are aware of what's happening every day on the show. So there's almost like an ironic listening to the show where, you know, they're watching, they're listening to the people that are listening to the show. They're just as interested in the whack packers that surround the show and the callers that call in. It's all a big circus. They want to see the circus from a distance. Whereas you've got the hardcore fans that want to, they're on there blogging about it while it's happening. They go to every event, and those people are great fans, and they're actually really good comedy audiences. But there's no one fan for the Stern Show. It's because it's gone from terrestrial to satellite. It's a VIP club. People
That's
pay
true.
That $12 a month, and they feel elite.
I mean, I always thought that Stern was the best and worst thing to happen to radio because he changed the dynamic. But at the same time, there were so many copycat, like so many people who didn't really understand what he was doing. That's just like, oh, you just go on the air and you talk about hookers.
Yeah.
And so just doing these radio tours where you know, like you get the Morning Zoo cruise, but then you get the, I'm the edgy Howard Stern wannabe.
Yeah.
We got a porn star. And, you know, and it was always like, well, there's a little more to it than that. It's not, don't just take the superficial qualities of the show.
Yeah, because there's not a, it's almost like a fire. It's like there's that core, you know, Howard and Robin and Fred and Gary, there's those players and there's relationships. And there's a point of view that's specific, and that spins out all those antics. Because that woman in studio is a reaction to the fact that you were not allowed to do certain things.
Right.
And so it wasn't just doing it to titillate, excuse the pun. It was done because they were angry at being told what they couldn't do. They were angry that they were always losers, and they were fighting to be winners.
And if you really listen to Howard, he's a thoughtful guy. Like, he's a very thoughtful dude.
He is, but at the same time, I think he is playing a character to a certain extent. I think he... look, he's a Jewish mensch from Long Island. He's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that there's times where he wants to play up that he's wilder than he is, because that's what people want to hear.
Right. But it takes a lot of energy to be that to be wild all the time.
Well, that's how my dad started in radio. Is he was like in his 20s as a PA, and he was working for these guys, Klavan and Fitch, who were legendary New York team. But they were older guys, and they used to come in at 4 a.m. for 20 years, and they were done. And my dad would come in hungover and late. And any other job, you'd be fired. They loved it because they wanted to hear the stories from the night before.
Right. Well, because it gives them content for the show.
Well, that's what Artie was. He was, you know, a guy who was bringing that world back into the studio again.
Mm-hmm.
And now that he's gone, the show actually has, you know, sort of, again, morphed into something a little bit different that still works. But they could use a wild guy again.
How do you feel? I mean, because you've been there through all of the radio, pretty much ups and downs since the 70s. Like, what? And now that radio feels like it's just kind of barely choking out its last few breaths. Like, and then even with satellite radio, you know, like next year when you can stream Pandora to your cars, what the fuck is going to happen to Sirius XM? You know,
I think it's. I mean, what's funny is their stock has been going up a lot.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and I don't know why. There's obviously the guys that know what's going on and the guys that don't. And it seems to me the pattern is like this. I mean, the fact that we are doing podcasting on a $500 recorder and putting it up for free,
mm-hmm.
people are getting it for free, and that's translating into people coming out to see us or hopefully buying my book, by the way.
When is that coming out?
November 9th.
And what's that
Chris?
Called? What's that called, Greg?
It's called Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons.
Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons, November 9th.
Yes, it's Simon & Schuster, but you can pre-order it at fitzdog.com. It's a thing they do now. You can buy it because you're so anxious.
Are you telling me, Greg, if I went to fitzdog.com Amazon.com, I could buy your book.
Yes, Chris, but wait, there's more.
Heart attack!
The ebook will be available with exclusive content like... Mm-hmm. The book is about letters that my mother received about me my whole life.
Okay.
Greg punched a kid in the face today. Detention slips, police reports. They used to clip out newspaper clippings when I was arrested. And then throughout my life, I saved them as an adult.
Okay.
You know, I found a box of this in the basement. And my mother had saved them all. Because they used to laugh at them. I'd come home from school. We'd be sitting at dinner. There'd be a letter from school. My dad would, you know, chain smoking his 3.5 packs a day of Viceroy's. Chain smoking at the table while we ate, you know, a clump of mashed potatoes with a piece of bleeding meat next to it. And he'd open up this letter. And if it was funny, they would laugh their ass off. You know when the teachers quote what you say the note?
Yeah.
And at one point she wrote, I was teaching positions in geometry, and Greg said, is there a 69 position? They wrote that down. And they burst out laughing. And so the message was, if it's funny enough, you're fine. If not, you're going to get a beating.
Oh, so your comedy roots started early with I'm going to hit you if you're...
High stakes comedy.
That is pretty high stakes.
So this book is sort of my life and how I've done the opposite of what I'm told to do my whole life and the results of it told through letters. And so I had celebrities read each of the letters as if they were the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're holding a pen and they're writing it down as they say it.
That's
and
awesome.
So I've got Pete Yorn, Natalie Maine, Zach Galifianakis, Kevin Neal, and Bob Saget. I mean, just every letter read by a different... So Chris, to answer your question,
yes.
Not only the book,
mm-hmm.
not only the ebook.
What else?
DearMrsFitzsimmons.com, where you, as a fan, can upload your letters that you might have received as a kid.
Can't take the input!
Chris, eyes now melt. Take a breath because anyone can do this. It's as simple as opening up your computer screen,
mm-hmm.
tapping onto your keyboard, and waiting for that book to come in on November 9th.
Greg, does Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons also make delicious julienne fries?
Well, it's funny you ask, Chris. I've never heard of those.
They're a thing. I don't know. They're a thing that I feel like a Ronco product at one time or another has made.
Oh, they create the actual fries.
They create the actual cut of the fries.
Yes, if you slap page 67 against 68 with a piece of potato in there.
So how do you, now that you've made the transition, how long have you been doing your podcast?
Almost a year. What am I saying? Over a year.
Over a year.
A year and a couple of months. I think yours started just after. No.
We started in February.
February, yeah. And you just came in like a fat girl at the public pool. Just splash! Chris Hardwick's here. The rest of us are. We got water wings on.
Now,
with water up our nose.
Is it weird that I was envisioning what kind of bathing suit I'd be wearing if I were a fat girl? Like a one piece with one little stripe across the top and then like a little bow up top.
I knew there'd be a bow.
Unnecessary bow.
Yeah, unnecessary bow.
And then you've got that extra flap of material over the upper thigh.
Yep,
not
that's
a
right.
Like a bathing skirt.
Yeah, a little bit of a bathing skirt. Yeah. But not that so you couldn't see a little bit of toe in the middle.
No, you want a little glimpse of the toe.
Yeah, but how have you found? I mean, it must. I see you at the top of the iTunes thing.
No, I'm doing very well. It's just you came in and shot to the top immediately, and I was look. There's certain people in this business. Less and less as I go further along, I resent very few people. But then there's some people that I'm really proud of when they do well. And I was very proud that
that's
you came.
So nice.
Because I felt like this is your world. I was surprised you hadn't done it yet. And then you came in and I feel like, what is it? The water rises, all the boats, the fat lady jumps in the pool.
Fat lady jumps in the
everybody
pool.
Everybody goes higher up in the water. And so, no, I was happy you did it. I think podcasting is, we are the pioneers of this style of podcasting. I mean, there was the wave 10 years ago.
Right.
Which I think was much more sort of industrial,
right.
You know, information.
So, I mean, like super early adoptery. Super early adoptery.
Yeah. And now we are, I think, communicating on a personal level with people. And we've got access, being in Hollywood, with people that the audience is interested in hearing from in a more personal, laid-back, not promoting something way. Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons, November 9th. And so I think that, you know, the dozen people like us, the comedians that are doing, not even dozen, you know, seven or eight maybe, I feel like every one of them, I enjoy listening to their podcasts. I love to go on theirs. I love to have them on mine. And I really do feel like we're like a baseball team.
Yeah, and I keep wanting to do like one like mega podcast show where it's like you and me and Carolla and you know
Billy Burr
and Bill Burr and you know I
Rogan.
Yeah, I asked Pardo, but he won't do it.
No,
no, he's like I said this on Doug Benson's I Love Movies podcast.
Oh, and Doug Benson.
And Doug Benson, Scott Aukerman does CDR Radio. Like, and so I said, Jimmy, I would love to do like a mega podcast. Oh, and he was like, oh, that sounds like a terrible idea. Like, he was so, oh, well, absolutely not. That is a terrible. That is awful. Why
well,
would
he's
I want
the
to
only one that charges. That's why.
Well, he has a different, you know, he has a, yeah, he's got that model. He's
yeah.
Got, he's got, like,
God
he's got
bless
the,
him.
He's got the premium model.
Yes. Why aren't we doing that?
You know, because, I'll tell you, because I thought
well,
about
I'll
it.
Tell you, Greg.
I'll tell you, Greg. Because it's, you know, he has, although podcast, I think, is doing pretty well on the iTunes charts, but you get a half hour of free content, and then the last half hour is premium content that you have to subscribe to.
First hit's free.
First half's free. And so I sort of felt like, you know, I didn't go into this show to try to make money from the show.
Yeah.
It was just much to the dismay of my co-hosts. But but I feel like it was more about I want as many people to hear it as possible because I want people to come out to shows. That's my goal with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you go into a direction of trying to, you know, well, I want to have subscribers and I want to, then you can get that. But I just feel like it shrinks the number by like a 20th because most people just don't want to.
You mean you'll get 2 out of 10 of your listeners?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Something along those lines. And so, you know, they might be an even more loyal crowd because they're really invested.
Yes.
But for me, it's just important to get people to come out to shows. So that's why.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same thing. I felt like, first of all, I was doing a radio show every Monday night for Howard. I still do it. Every Monday, it's an hour, and it always feels like I make all the effort of getting a good – you've been on it.
Yeah, yeah.
Of getting a good guest to come all the way down to Venice to my studio where we do it in Hollywood. And then the hour ends, and it's like that. And people are like, that's it?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started doing the podcast just because, fuck it, I got somebody here already. Let's do another. You've done the podcast.
Yeah, I did.
Right?
I did it with Joanna Angel.
Oh, that's right. Because you've done my show at least 2 times.
I did your show once with, what's the kid? He does the Asking McGee show.
Oh, Will Hayes.
Yes, and he was hammered and he was a mess. Like, he's a guy that you want on your radio show because he has insane stories.
Yeah, yeah.
But he genuinely was he was a mess.
Yeah, he had just been arrested and he had spent the night in jail in the hospital for doing bad coke.
And just a sweet guy. Like, he seemed like a sweet guy.
Very sweet guy.
But he just, like, he tells the kind of stories where you're like, how are you not dead? Like, they're insane.
Yeah. So, yeah, you did that. And then you did Joanna Angel along with the podcast, I believe.
Yeah.
And then, so I started adding that extra hour, and then people were complaining. I love when they complain. It's free. And, you know, you take a week off, man, you get ready for hate mail. It's amazing.
I've been too afraid to take a week off. I keep thinking, like, maybe we should take a month off, like, you know, regroup, focus on, like, season 2.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't think I think this is this is fucking speed. Like, we can't take it below 50 miles an hour.
And you do 1 a week or 2 a week?
Just one.
And then you do, and you never take a week off. And do you ever do solo podcasts?
Yeah, only if I'm on the road and these guys aren't out of town with me and it's someone like if I'm in New York or like then I don't really have a choice.
Yeah, and you interview people at the club. That's what I usually
do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll talk to people one-on-one.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the general consensus is that I think, you know, like just so you guys know, people love Matt and Joan on the podcast. They're like
they have better.
I mean, but
we have brought so much to the table today.
I think talking one-on-one just is a different dynamic, and it's just more fun when there's a group of dudes as opposed to me, like, getting all Charlie Rose on someone.
It sure is, Chris.
Joe, you're fired.
Well,
how dare
you
patronize me? You're fired for no money.
It's a different rhythm when you're alone, you know? It's really hard to regulate, you know, if am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Am I transitioning enough? You know, but when I've done it, though, I've found that the feedback on those is stronger than when I have a guest because I don't know, maybe the stand-up in you comes out and you feel like you got to push harder to, you know, get personal and...
Yeah, I get really serious when it's one-on-one because I just, you know, like, there isn't a counterbalance.
Yeah.
So if the other person isn't super jokey, then we just start going down more serious pathways and I sometimes...
Well, let's be really funny for like 5 minutes. What do you want to talk about? Bottled water? Here's what's great about America. Seriously. We have so much water, which is why we're wealthy, right?
Right.
I mean, if you look at the poor countries, what is consistent? Fucking dry.
Dry or filthy water.
Well, that's why it's dry. I mean, yeah, you got shit water, but I mean, it's not... So what do we have in this country? So much water. We have fountains.
Yeah.
We shoot water in the air.
To music. Not even Tchaikovsky. If you go to the Grove, it's
singing Journey.
It's Glee or it's Lionel Richie.
Yes.
All night long.
Can you imagine going to, say, Zimbabwe and blasting water in the air to Lionel Richie? What people would do?
Dave Anthony has a fucking awesome joke about, like, how do you explain an eating contest to someone in Africa? They're like, well, you take these three fat guys.
Yeah.
Fat guy?
Yeah. And then when they're done eating, they go and they take a giant shit in the toilet. What's a toilet? Well, it's a bowl of clean water that we shit and piss in.
Oh, I remember shit.
That's how, you know what? That's how you can tell how fucking, how spoiled Americans are. Like, if you go into a bathroom and the water's dirty, you don't want to shit.
Yes.
Like,
Oh my God,
I can't shit into this dirty water.
Yeah, and I will not sit on a toilet seat to shit in water without taking a piece of a tree and laying it across the seat
itself.
So I don't
have to touch.
And is there a disease you can get from sitting on a toilet seat? I don't believe there is.
The heebie-jeebies.
I think
that's from the Latin heebie-jeebies.
I mean, you would literally have to sit in someone else's shit, like a pile of someone else's shit. But then I think, yeah, but there's shiza porn. Like, people shit in each other's mouths and they seem okay, right? Don't they?
Shiza porn?
German
shiza porn. I like how that just flies out of your mouth like sunflower seeds.
I know.
Shiza porn. Shiza porn.
Well, you're friends with a lot of porn stars.
Yeah, you got that right.
What was fun about Joanna Angel, who was a very smart girl.
Very smart.
And I don't mean that, like, for a porn star. She's smart. I mean, like, she was a smart girl.
Look, she runs a big, successful company. Doesn't matter what it is.
Let me ask you this about porn stars, because even the ones, you know...
They're on lockdown right now.
Wait, are we done with the funny? Because it sounds like we're going down serious.
This could be serious funny,
okay.
Depending on
that's the thing about porn.
Answer.
You think porn's funny, and you start talking about it. It's neither sexy nor funny.
No, because...
They shut down. Like, I read this morning.
Yeah, because someone had HIV, so they had to shut down the industry for a while. So... You know, you look at girls like Sasha Grey or whatever that are like, no, I'm doing this because I want to do this and it's empowering because I'm a woman and I can make that choice. But then you say that and like every porn star after like 2 or 3 years, they look pretty chewed up. Like it can't be a healthy way to live. Am I crazy about that?
Well, it's not healthy when the testing is as bad. My friend is the head of health services for STDs in Los Angeles, and his number one focus is the fact that the porn industry is there. It is the worst system of checking for STDs. There's one company that does all the testing. They do it as long as it's within 30 days, which is not comprehensive, since obviously you could be having sex before then.
Right.
And they don't test the anus. They don't test the back of the throat, where a lot of diseases are.
Uh-huh.
And it's completely flawed. So this was a matter of time until this was going to happen.
And it's amazing for a multi-billion-dollar industry that there's not, like I would think, if I'm a medical company, I would probably want to get in on that action.
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, you look at how a movie is made. You got unions, sets, lighting, transportation, giant salaries, and they make money. Porn, they pay the actors less than a grand a scene. The men make half of that. They shoot it in a fucking warehouse. No unions,
right.
No lighting. It's all digital cameras. They can't throw out $1,000 for some testing.
Right.
It's insane. Yeah. They have no bottom line at all, and these are human beings.
Right.
This is not funny, Chris.
This is interesting to me, though, because you're so tied in. How did you get tied in? Was it from the Stern Show? How did you get tied in?
I think so, yeah. They had approached me, but they said... This was the greatest. Because it started with nine guys in raincoats in a hotel room in Vegas is how this award show started, you know, like 10, right. 15 years ago. Bill Hicks hosted it one year.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he was one of the early hosts. And now I was performing for 7,000 people at Mandalay Bay on Showtime. And so they approached me and I had to audition to be the host of the Porn Awards. So the guy who runs it, Paul Fishbein, who's actually really, again, really nice guy, kids, nice wife who I'm friends with,
yeah.
comes out and I go on stage at the Improv and I do 20 minutes effortlessly because we all have a stockpile of porn jokes.
Of course.
And they go, yeah, we'd love you to do it. So I said, yeah, let me just run it by my wife. And then I said, run it by my wife? So I just told her, you know, I'm going to the bagel shop that weekend.
For the whole weekend.
And I came back 2 days later.
With a sack of money.
Yeah, and no bagel. Forgot the bagels.
Is your wife cool with that, by the way?
No, she is. She came with me, and she is not jealous at all. I mean, you are you married or just girlfriend long-term?
Long-term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a point of trust that if you don't have, you just can't be in a relationship.
It's not only, trust, but there's also a level of comfort where it's like, you know, because we're... Jan and I are at the point where, like, when I go out of town, like, we don't have to talk every day.
Yeah.
Because we get on the phone and be like, what are you doing? Nothing, what are you doing?
Yeah.
All right, well, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
And yeah, what are we in high school?
It doesn't mean we love each other any less. We're just not up in each other's business.
Yeah,
all
there's
the time.
A shorthand. I've actually found that I love emailing my wife. Even in town, I email her instead of calling her. And, I don't know. It's just, for me, her coming to the Porn Awards was not about her keeping an eye on me. It was because she was fascinated by this world, she wanted to see it. And it was we were invited to an orgy after the show.
Oh, formal invite?
Yes.
Save the date.
It was written on the side of a rubber. we said, of course, let's go up. It was in like a penthouse in Mandalay Bay. And so we go up there and it's like, you know, Jenna Jameson, and she's with Tito Ortiz, who used to be her husband or boyfriend. Like all celebrities, Ron Jeremy and... And we're standing around. I mean, there's like 50 people. And they got a bar, a couple bartenders, and people are schmoozing. There's hors d'oeuvres. And then there's all these mattresses set up. And it's not necessarily that everybody's in the orgy. It's going to be kind of like a street fight in the alley.
Okay.
And some people get involved. You're not sure who.
Right.
And so we're standing around. And then after about 15, 20 minutes, whatever sexual buzz was in the air... just became like boredom and a feeling of, I guess, almost like, you know, when you're at a restaurant that you weren't sure you should go in and order food from and you do, and then it takes too long and so you just leave.
Yeah, yeah.
It was that, so we just took off.
Or it's just, probably I was just watching like animals fuck after a while, like, no, this is the mechanical act of sex where the thing goes in the thing.
I can't imagine orgies smelling too good after a little bit.
No, and you can't open windows in Vegas.
Yeah.
They are sealed shut. And it's real, and at least the animals aren't staring at the camera acting like,
on a t-shirt. That's my favorite joke. Quotes ever. I can't imagine orgies smelling too good. That's so earnest.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, since we're on the topic.
Yeah. Hey, how was that orgy last night?
Oh,
like a bouquet of flowers. Oh. Yeah, that's the thing about sex. Even when you've had sex, the smell is not great. It's great while you're having sex. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as it's over... everyone jumps up to rinse the undercarriage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We need to make some sort of like orgy stick ups or, you know, renews its fuck plugins or something. It's like cock shaped and they go.
Yeah, the vibrators should have tiny intake fans.
No, the vibrators could be like the ionizers, you know, like Brookstone. You get it from Brookstone, and it's just like a tiny little motor, and it just like it soaks in all of the odor and then spits out clean, breathable air.
Yeah, and all the lube is like scented oils, heavily scented oils.
Yes.
I mean, we can make orgies better. Isn't this funny? What could be better than an orgy? And we're trying to improve on it. Meanwhile, poor people are dying because they don't have clean water.
But they could have orgies.
That's so true. But how would they wash the undercarriage when they're done?
Well, you don't have to worry about it at that point. We're spoiled Americans.
They're so dry, they probably barely come.
I don't know, guys. I don't listen. I don't know if anyone owns the domain third world orgies, but I think it's like, there's a fetish.
Hey, when you blow, do you swallow? Swallow what?
Nothing. For sustenance, yes. So I can survive.
If anything comes out, you bet your ass. That's the protein. More protein I've had all month.
Listen, I don't...
You can clip that out of the podcast.
We might clip that out, or we might leave it in to juxtapose it with letters to Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons.
That's right. It's a sweet book, but with a dark side.
So your book comes out November 9th. You can pre-order it now. You have Fitzdog Radio.
All available at Fitzdog.com.
Fitzdog.com.
And then, a bunch of tour dates coming up. I got West Palm Beach Improv coming up at the end of October. And nice. Then I'm in Philadelphia, Seattle, all in the next few weeks.
You're doing Helium?
Doing Helium.
I love Helium.
Great club.
Fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's really just it's a fun collection of people. And the room is, low ceiling, tight. You fill it up.
I dig Philadelphia. Yeah. I had a nice time when I was there. I was there a couple months ago. It was great.
Yeah, and it's like, it's great when you're working in a city that you like to hang out in during the day, too. Sometimes they're like, yeah, you're working St. Louis. And you're like, oh, that'll be cool. And then you land, and they pick you up, and they drive you to the club, and you're looking out the back window going like, hey, dude, it's Philly. St. Louis is back that way. Where the hell are we going? And you're like 45 minutes out in like a mini mall with nothing.
Yep.
And you could be anywhere, and you're nowhere.
Those tour dates are called Hello Applebee's, because that's pretty much the only...
It's Applebee's.
Applebee's or chicken tenders at the club.
And, hey, do you have a health club? Yeah, we do, sir. Right down the hall to the left. And you open up the door, and it's like a rusty exercise bike.
Yep.
And one of those rubber bands that you pull on.
Yep. And that's pretty much it.
Oh.
And then guys boxing with big curly mustaches. And unitards.
Yes.
That's how antiquated those places.
Abner Doubleday is swinging a bat in the corner.
It is that old. There are women's suffrage signs on the wall. I mean, it is an old place.
Oh, my God. I'm not saying it's bad, but the instructions on how to use the bike are written as a cave drawing.
As cave drawings, where you're pulling a bison's horns to lift your biceps. Well, Greg Fitzsimmons, thank you so much for being on the Nerdist Podcast. I'm so glad we finally got you on, and I'm thrilled, and I hope people buy your book.
I appreciate you having me on. I'm really happy for you with this podcast. I enjoy listening to it, and I hope that we can all do a live event together. I think that would be fun.
Someday we will. Maybe we will. We'll just do like a big live charity event, and we'll do it all together, and then everyone can put it out on their own little streams.
We should have a Sidekicks podcast. You mean actually?
I thought you meant from the old TV show Sidekicks with the kid who was on.
He's dead. He's dead.
What was the movie Sidekicks?
There's a movie Sidekicks. He hung himself.
Oh, Jonathan, was it Jonathan Brandis?
Jonathan Brandis. Way to end the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, starting to pull it out of the HIV
you can
thing.
Enjoy him on Sequest, DMV.
But, and what about a tour? Can you imagine a tour with, like, Bill Burr, me, you, Rogan?
It'd be impossible, because it would be too it'd be too expensive to pay everyone. Because when you start doing that,
Unless it would be huge.
It would have to be enormous, like, because when you start talking about, like...
Do it in giant stadiums.
I would love to do a comedy tour, and I'd love these five people to be on, and then you realize, like, well, it costs $5,000 just to get the theater.
Yeah.
Like, it just... Then it becomes too expensive.
Yeah.
If you guys sell tickets for $5,000 each...
Yeah, I don't know. Down the road. I think it's
good to look down the road at maybe.
Yeah,
doing
I mean, once
like
we start getting big ad revenue coming in and we can tour. I mean, like you said, radio's going away. This is it.
Yep, podcasting is it. Enjoy your burrito, America.
Is that how you end every show?
That's how. This is only the second time.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.